Greetings from K9 to Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum. End of message.
Good day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 180 of the Diddly Dum Podcast.
180!
The fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
And I'm Mark.
And we are here to look back on Capital 6 decades a couple of weekends ago, and so we're just going to get hold of our guest, Tony Jordan. Mark, you got that grapnel on the end of the rope?
Oh, yes, hold on, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Get his throat upwards.
Oh, me back.
Oh, God, one of the prongs has sort of snagged the turn-ups of Tony's Bermuda shorts. Start pulling, guys. And as we, inch by inch, drag Tony down from his standard post-convention position on the ceiling. Grab his ankles, Mark!
I got him!
Ooh.
Right, just hold these very large metal weights, will you, Tony? That should be okay.
Where are they dangling from, though?
Tony, the question which we always ask rather nervously, intensively, after a Capital convention. How are you?
Yes, I'm good, thank you, boys. I'm very good. In fact, I'm so good that I went on another visit to the venue for next year yesterday.
Oh.
I know, I can't get enough of it.
It's that good?
Because it's somewhere completely different. I just wanted to go back now that this year's is out of the way and just look around again and have a chat and just throw some ideas at them. Don't worry, I am not going to spend the next 12 months going there every week or whatever. So there we are. That's what I did yesterday. And we can see what you thought of the weekend now, can't we?
Well, of course, this is on the weekend of the 14th and 15th of April.
15th and 16th of April.
Was it?
Yeah.
I think Tony probably knows. He's tattooed indelibly across his brain, probably.
Well, of course, this is on the weekend of the 15th and 16th of April. Mark, Hayden and I attended the Doctor Who Appreciation Society's Capital Convention, the Capital 6 Decades Convention in Crawley. Hayden can't be with us today, unfortunately, because William, his little two-year-old, has been struck down by chickenpox, which is one of those things that's so itchy that Hayden and Sophie have not had a minute's sleep since he came down with it. So Hayden is resting. But we have with us the man, I was going to say, to blame for it all, the man responsible for it all, Mr. Tony Jordan.
Yes, hello, hello, after all this nonsense, hello, and once again, good evening.
So, Tony, what was your general look back on the convention and success?
I think I do this every year. I'm only going on the feedback that I've had in person, or that I heard over the weekend, or that I have read on social media. And it was remarkably 100% positive. I've not heard a single complaint or moan about anything, which is extraordinary.
That's because we've not spoken to us yet.
That is bad, actually. How many people were there?
320 over the weekend.
Right, okay. So, well, that's not bad then, to not have a single complaint.
I was just thrilled with how it went. It felt as though all the work that had gone into the Capital since I first came up with the idea in 2015 and the first one was in 2016, it's as though we'd built up to this plateau, which was amazing as we were celebrating 60 years of Doctor Who. And the fact that the plan I had all along was to have 13 panels, one for each Doctor. And that worked spectacularly well, I felt. So, yeah, happy man. Very tired man by the Sunday night. I went to bed about 10:45, which was unbelievable, but there you go.
Oh, yes, you stay an extra night, don't you, to have a little bit of an unwind and a debriefing?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we also have to go through things the following morning with the hotel and, yeah, just catch up with ourselves. So I got home on the Monday evening at about 7 o'clock, having left at 9:30 on the Thursday morning. So it's a full-on 5 days, but well worth it.
Going through a few things with the hotel at the end, is that where the police come in and say, so, Mr. Jordan, did you or did you not assault the bar manager?
Well, I'm delighted to say that they actually did what they didn't do last year. They had plenty of staff, much better organisation. They were so keen on buffets that they got one going for the Friday night and the Sunday night, as well as the Saturday. And I thought it was great. We didn't have massive queues at the bar and people were getting their food in good time, so that the hotel did well. And by doing that, obviously, they did very well on their F&B revenue. So happy day all round.
I thought that was interesting, given that there were more people than before, because I don't think we were joining any of the autograph queues ourselves, so we may not have noticed, but there didn't seem to be the problems that you sometimes have with the autograph queues snaking back and forth and back and forth and people not being able to get past. It seems to be.
Yeah, I noticed that. When I was walking through the corridors, like from the bar area to the main hall and stuff, which takes you past the autograph rooms and past the photograph studio, there really didn't seem to be the packed corridors that we've had in years past, like the packed, sweaty corridors.
The autograph rooms were relocated to where the dealer's room was last year.
Yeah.
Therefore, the queues in particular for the bigger of them, it did actually snake out through various rooms. It was incredibly long at times. On Saturday, perhaps inevitably, Katie Manning took 2 hours. And I think on Sunday, the lovely Louise Jameson probably took 2 hours. But because we were out of the way, it didn't affect the main hotel, which was a distinct advantage. The layout worked much better. The dealers were happy. I was happier. Robin was very happy with where the photo studio was. So that all worked really well. And it was a question of learning from the previous year. You must remember that the original plan I did was in 2019. And then obviously we lost 2 years due to COVID. And what looks good on a piece of paper doesn't always work. And taking everything on board, we reorganised it quite significantly, and it definitely worked. And I know the queues were long, but you can't do anything about it. And people waited, and yeah, the autographs were really successful, particularly Stephen Moffat's.
I talked your photographs. I've just been looking today at a couple of photographs you posted on Facebook of you, Fraser and Wendy this year. And when was the first one?
It was almost exactly 10 years ago. It was beginning of May 2013, so it's near as you can get for 10 years ago.
And to put it tactfully, Wendy hasn't aged a day, and I shan't say anything other.
Won't you? Well, I have another photo, not like this where we've posed in as an identical position as possible, but I have photos of myself with Colin and Nicola from 1986 and from the weekend of the Capitol, and that will be going up in due course. And there's definitely change. Actually, no, Nicola hasn't changed at all, but Colin and myself definitely have.
Now, the event opens Saturday. Well, we all turned up on Friday afternoon, evening, met a few people who turned up early. Then Saturday morning, the event opens with Mr. President himself, Colin, arriving. What was this 6-minute film that you had? Because we missed that.
The opening video for Saturday was actually 7 minutes long, that was done by Karen Davis. And then we had a completely different one on Sunday morning, 6 minutes, that was done by Mark Stammers. So we're talking about colleagues of mine on the executive from the noughties and the tens, and a colleague of mine from the executive from the 1980s. So I thought that was quite nice, because that's reflecting the decades as well.
Mm.
Both of them were celebrations of 60 years of Doctor Who. This was the key thing. It wasn't any other convention. It was 6 decades, 60 years, Capital 6. And that's what we were drilling home. I was drilling that home for months in advance, wasn't I think?
Yeah. I have to say, the people that we talked to, I think a lot of people were very impressed with the lineup for the panels and the guests, actually. And like you say, because you did that 6 decades, sounds like I'm blowing smoke somewhere here, but it's genuinely, people seemed really impressed with the spread of panels across the era, and the fact that we had so many companions there as well. And, you know, and to cap it off, we had a doctor in Colin, and we had Stephen Moffat as well. So
it worked really well. I think we only had... We had two people cry off in the whole of the year between Capitals, which was Sophie, who I knew about in November, but we announced in January when she was going down under. and yeah. Derek Ritchie, who is filming a series with, I can't remember. Anyhow, he's filming a series, so he couldn't make it. But your fear is always that people will suddenly get work last minute or that they'll be unwell in the lead up to it. And the great news was that we didn't get any cry-offs. Everyone turned up and the guests all had a great time, I think. So all the planning paid off. But you need a bit of luck not to have someone suddenly come down sick. So I know that when Martin Parsons was doing his Who's at the Playhouse in Epsom in February, when I couldn't go to that because I got COVID, he lost three guests in the last two or three days, Katie, Maureen and someone other. I can't remember who it was. These things happen. So luck was on our side, but I also think that the planning we put into it paid off quite well. Not wishing to blow my own trumpet, but it did work.
So the first panel was the Sixth Doctor's era, Colin, Nicola, and Dean Hollingsworth, of whom more later. It occurred to me, Tony, about the panels. Of course, you wouldn't have been in a lot of them, would you? Because you'd have been running around like a blue-arsed Doctor Who fan, shall we say.
Yeah. I will probably see the panels in August when Keith Barnfather sends me the videos over. I saw the beginning. Well, I was in there doing the introduction. I saw the beginning of that panel. And then I came up for the end because I knew that we were going to present Colin with his outstanding contribution to Doctor Who Award. So I came to the back of the panopticon and I did a wind-up signal, which Colin caught on and was laughing and joking about. And I go, yeah, that's fine. I know why I'm doing it, Colin, you don't. It was so that Karen could come on and present him with that, and really well deserved. He is the ultimate ambassador for Doctor Who in many ways. He's been tremendous for nearly 40 years now. He is obviously the honorary president, and it was great to be able to surprise him with that award. And I can tell you now that every of the four awards that were given out, none of the recipients had the vaguest idea in advance. And I tell you what, the auditorium was absolutely heaving. It was standing room only for that and the second panel as well. It was just incredible.
They always seem quite touchingly touched, don't they, by those awards?
Well, it's unexpected. And I think we can go through it. I think every single one was totally justified. So there we go. So that was a great start.
And Colin hits 80 in June, doesn't he?
He is indeed. He is indeed. And he was at Scarborough the following week. He'll be here, there and everywhere going around. So he's still clocking up the miles, hopefully not clocking up the speed too much. I believe it was a great panel because Dean and I had got to know each other. I said in the preview, I think, at Time Lash in October. And Dean came over with his lovely wife, Lila, from Guernsey for the weekend. And it was always going to be Colin and Nicola to start with. And then Dean went on after about 20 minutes or so. But we had the second Time Lash panel in six capitals. So that's got to be something unique.
Just rubbing it in. That was followed by the second panel, which was the Stephen Moffat panel. Again, we were saying after the Terrence Dicks event at Riverside a while ago this year that Stephen Moffat had impressed greatly and he was on great form again.
You know, I have enormous respect for the man. I don't know whether you read what he post. I'll tell you what he said. I emailed him a couple of days after thanking him profusely for his contribution. He emailed me at 8:50 on the morning. On that morning, he said, "I'm on my way." And he was with us by 9:45. You know, he didn't need to be there till between 9:15 and 10:30. So he turned up early, which was absolutely fantastic. But he then, after the event, I sent him an email. He said, "Bah, bah, bah. Sorry I had to dash. It was a weirdly busy weekend. I woke up that morning wondering how I was going to get through it all. With a statuette of Roger Delgado was the surprising answer." And if you've seen on his Instagram and his Twitter, he's put photos of the statue at the back of the theatre at the penultimate performance of The Unfriend on the Saturday night.
I'll have to look that out.
And the banter between him and Russell T. Davis and Michelle Gomez was absolutely top draw.
Oh, I missed the Michelle Gomez one. I saw the with Russell T. Davis. I believe Russell T. Davis said that William Ems was robbed or something. The writer of Galaxy 4.
Yeah, Russell T. Davis said, "I voted William Ems." Moff said, "Yeah, but he didn't show up." Russell Davis replied, "Them's the breaks." Then Russell said, "Congratulations, I genuinely forgot to say so." And Stephen said, "Envy my greatness till they find William Ems in the river." But then, in another conversation on the same thing, Stephen said, the photo. She said, Michelle Gomez in her younger years. And Michelle replied, I still have that jawline and I'm working on the beard. So this really, and then Neil Gaiman comes in and says, well done and well deserved. So it really took off amongst, you know, top people on Instagram.
Yeah.
It was great. It was great. And I think people probably thought that I had managed to persuade Stephen Moffat to come because we were going to give him the Terence Dicks Award for Writers. And we know from last October what a massive fan of Terence he was. Yeah. But I absolutely didn't. Mm. I thought that would be the worst possible thing to do. If Stephen wanted to come, he would come. He'd gone by 1:45 because he had to be at a screening in Soho at 3:00. And then he went on to the Unfriend performance that evening, the penultimate performance. And he worked tirelessly, again, like he did at Riverside in October. He donated his fee to charity, to Parkinson's, all his autograph money to Parkinson's as well. He just gave his time freely, and it was absolutely wonderful. And he's so funny on stage. Mm. And it's another panel I look forward to seeing in due course. In October at Riverside, I made sure I sat down and watched it because I knew that wasn't going to be recorded. But the man's a brilliant guest, and my opinion of him as a human being could not be higher.
The award, of course, listeners, was Stephen became the second recipient of the Terence Dicks Writers Award, presented by last year's winner, Gary Russell. And they didn't actually come to blows on the stage, did they?
No, they did afterwards in the green room, but we'll keep that quiet. Unfortunately, the Dicks family, they had a family event on the Saturday, so they couldn't join us, which was a great shame. And Elsa had let me know that in advance, and that was the only day, that was the day that Stephen could make. So it was the Saturday. I've been in contact with Elsa since the event. She's aware of the day next year. They hope to come up to Birmingham for it next year, when we will hopefully, God willing, be presenting the third annual Terence Dicks Award for Writers. I think it's brilliant that we're working with the Dicks family, and you know the concept of it. And yeah, I think it's great, and it's out there with Stephen's posts on Instagram and Twitter, and I believe Facebook as well. So there you go. That was a great panel, and it was heaving, wasn't it? It was absolutely heaving. It was standing room only, though.
Yeah, yeah, that was a must-see, I think, as well. And he was really good as well. Just some of the little sound bites and things he came out with. Like, I think he referred to Peter Capaldi as he gave Capaldi there wasn't any audition. He just was like, oh, well, if Peter Capaldi wants it, he can have it. And he's a fan, a nuts fan, he called him. Another thing I noted down that he said was when he was discussing the Five-ish Doctors. And he was talking about how good people need to be actors. And he said, you know, he was definitely going to stick to writing because, as you would have seen in The Five-ish Doctors, even the part of Stephen Moffat is surprisingly out of my range.
He's very self-deprecating. And
very
I think that's a great trait.
Yes, no more so than when he was talking about the end of his tenure. I know a lot of people said this, I think we possibly said it on the podcast as well, but to quote Stephen Moffat, exactly, excuse the language, he says about Peter Capaldi, he says, he's regenerating for 3 f***ing episodes. he says, and then with Twice Upon a Time, he said that he was basically busking for an hour to get to the bit everyone's interested in.
Well, of course, Twice Upon a Time was only written because Chris Chibnall didn't want to take over with a Christmas Day episode.
He was very honest about that, wasn't he?
Yeah, amazing. Yeah.
Obviously, you all know that he was meant to regenerate at the end of the... Is it the Doctor Falls?
Yeah, the World Enough and Time and the Doctor Falls, yeah.
And strangely, that as he was saying his brief thank you for the Terence Award, he mentioned, and this may well just have been, that he was delighted to be among such charming groups of Doctor Who fans, that it's great to be back with Doctor Who again. And we thought, what did he say, Mark?
We're Doctor Who fans.
No, he said, I wrote the quote down, exactly word for word what he said. At the end of it, he turned round, and as he held the Writers' Award aloft, he said, it's delightful to be back in the world of Doctor Who.
Is that what he said?
That's it.
Oh, which almost seemed like a slip, almost as if he's saying, do you know what, I've been enjoying being back in the world of Doctor Who, as if he might be doing more than just the convention, but there we are.
That's the word out there in social media, is that he has written at least one episode for Shooty, so we'll see, won't we?
Well, I mean, you would view him, wouldn't you? Because suddenly the pressure's off, and it's like, would you like to do an episode? And you probably just think, do you what, and I just have to write it, hand it in, and yeah, I bet he would. So,
I think it's a bit like for him, he's done this, he's done that. They've done, you know, all the things he's done with Mark Gatiss and Sherlock, and then we had Dracula. This is the thing, his West End show premiered at Chichester last year, and then it's been in the, you know, the Unfriend's been in the West End. And it's like he's really ticked a massive box. And so he's happy to go back to Doctor Who. I think that's similar to RTD, because he did all these drugs, and then he ate a sin. He did ate a sin. It was a huge success. It ticked a box, and he was happy to go back to Doctor Who as well. Does that sound feasible?
Yes.
He also went into quite some detail about, which again is something I don't think you ought to be surprised at guests being honest. But I think sometimes you, when particularly when it's someone like Stephen, who is, you know, his career is still ongoing, you think, oh, I thought he might have been there, might have not have said that. But he was talking about, I think someone asked what's the thing that surprised him most about being a showrunner. And he said it's, you know, the extent to which the first draft presented to you by the writer bears no resemblance to the final draft, given how much work the showrunner has to end up doing on it.
Well, the showrunner is this. I know there's a script editor, but the showrunner is effectively the script editor and the producer of Classic Who, all in one, isn't it?
Yeah. He even said Russell never let him in on the level of rewriting that was required either.
Well, of course, he wouldn't have known, because Russell never touched his scripts, did he?
No, that's true.
Likewise, I'm sure he won't be touching the script if he's done one for series 14. We know for a fact that, because Robert Shearman has said it many times over the years, that I think he did 5 drafts of Dalek and then left it to Russell to finish when he just couldn't face doing it anymore, you know? That's what happens. And I'm sure, we'll see. We don't know. Officially, we don't know who's writing which of the 8 episodes for the series, do. We know, I think, that Russell has written all 3 of the specials. I would imagine he'll have done the vast majority of series 8, but we'll find out in due course.
That then segued into a panel with Sarah Sutton and Matthew Waterhouse. And of course, with Adric being on stage, that was when Hayden and I realised that Mark had put glue on our chairs. So we had to say for that as well.
It wasn't as full for their panel, but it was still very full. And I just feel that I think it's nice that Sarah and Matthew have time to break out when they haven't got Janet or Peter on stage with them.
Yes.
They are not... You know, those two are very strong personalities, and they don't get so much in. The two of them together work really well. And I haven't seen it, but I've heard it went. It was a very good panel, and quite frankly, it made a finale of an amazing 2.5 hours opening the weekend. If I say so myself, you know.
Yeah, I enjoyed listening to Matthew Waterhouse talk about his knowledge of comics and stuff was great, especially at the start when he was just running through the entire history of Doctor Who in comics and stuff. I found that very entertaining, and also, but very poignant when he said, as we've heard before, I think, and I think it's in his book, isn't it? But he said on the stage, he said, on my first day of Doctor Who in the morning, I had a poster of Tom Baker on my wall, and then after I'd come home, it had been folded away and put in the eaves. And I thought, oh, how sad.
Yeah, that's how it was at the time. Apparently, it was a really good end to the morning, so.
Matthew ended by talking about this new audio novel that he's doing called Prisoners of London, which he described as, he has written for it, the definitive Tegan. So that might come across as Prisoners of London, this time it's personal.
And Sarah Sutton was like, why haven't I been invited? He says, oh no, I perform all the parts. And she was like, oh, I see, do you do Tegan as well? And he said, yes, I think you'll find it's the definitive Tegan. Which I thought was, which is very typical of his sense of humour.
Yeah. It's very dry, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
Laconic, perhaps.
Yes.
If I look at what that means.
Next panel was Stuart Milligan and Dan Starkey.
What happens, because there's a demand to have group companion photo shoots, so there was 5 companions and Collie, that overran, so we started 15 or 20 minutes late in the afternoon because of that. And I think we chopped 5 minutes off Stuart and Dan's panel. And then we went straight into Katie with myself. So I can't talk about that because I didn't see it. But I was sort of involved in the Katie panel. So I know what happened there. I shocked her by asking a question about Doctor Who. She talked for 2 minutes and then said, I can't remember. That was about the mutants. And then it was just Saturday afternoon with Katie. No tea this time, but it's just fantastic fun. And people seem to love you know, it's just like, well, we are friends, and it's just like friends talking.
That comes across as well, I think, in the panel. I know it's a regular feature of the Capitol, and I hope it, and long may it last as well. So.
And I can only reiterate, I said it on stage early on, Jonathan Turner had put on, posted on Twitter the week before the event, that Katie is the heart of the Capitol. And to me, she is. And that's why I said she's the heart, and I'm just a capillary.
Oh, don't be so vain.
I aspire to be a capillary. She represents, she exudes everything that I feel the Capitol should be in one woman, one person. Mm-hmm. She's so fantastic. She's been the only guest at all six Capitols. And I emailed her just earlier today, belatedly thanking her for her massive contribution and giving her the dates for next year. And I sincerely hope she comes, because she's definitely welcome.
One day, perhaps she might end up being an honorary president.
I don't think there's a vacancy at the moment, so we'll
No, indeed not. Indeed, I'm not suggesting there's likely to be one anytime soon.
So there were various breaks for autograph sessions and photo sessions. Next panel was Cammie Dowish and John Davey.
When Cammie arrived, he'd done a signing before, but he'd never been to a convention, and I could see that he was a little bit trepidatious. But as the day went on, he grew into it. We had some fantastic bants in the green room with him. And I'm led to believe that his panel with John went really well. John told me he'd had a very, not telling Cammie what to do. Cammie's a very experienced actor, how these things work and whatever. And Cammie stayed that night. We'd booked him in. But I think he had a most wonderful time. He really enjoyed it. So that's fantastic. And I'm delighted that we got him along. Robbie Dunlop suggested him to me as a guest, and I leapt on that. I thought, how fantastic. He was in it for a very short time, but it was a very memorable appearance, and people will be delighted to meet him and hear from him.
The next panel after that was Andrew Cartmell with Stephen Wyatt, Stephen, who we interviewed last year. In fact, his when I got home from Manchester this afternoon, his DVD of, what's it called, Who, Him and Me, was on the doorstep. His audio drama of...
Who and Him and Me, or something like that.
JNT and Gary Downey. Yeah.
Andrew was on fine form. He was thrilled because he sold every one but one of the books that he brought. So he was delighted with that, and he was sparkling. And I saw him and Stephen Moffat having a chat shortly before Stephen went on stage. And that was lovely to see. You think of it. A man who started steering Doctor Who in a new direction, talking with another man who, half a generation, more than that, nearly a generation later, was steering it in a different direction. So that was lovely to see. But I know Andrew was absolutely delighted. He had a really good day. And his panel, again, the feedback again was really good. And Stephen, he was staying the night. And the one night I stayed up late, I stayed up till 1 o'clock on a Saturday night. And he was rolling around by then and having a good time. He wasn't the only person who was drunk in the bar at 1 a.m.
I think we should emphasise that was Stephen Wyatt and not Stephen Moffat.
No! This is Stephen with a PH, not Stephen with a V.
Oh, yes, yeah, Stephen Wyatt was having a wonderful time, wasn't he, in the bar of the night? He was absolutely beaming.
Yeah, no, he was loving it. Well, we have a symbiotic relationship because we're both old Latimerians, although he left about 14, he was there about 14 years before me. So we have a natural empathy.
We saw him because we were hanging out with Gareth Cavanaugh and Ian Winterton from Cutaway Comics.
Who obviously he's worked with.
He works with them at the moment. So he came over towards the end of the night just before I headed off to bed and sat down. And he was clearly having a lovely time.
Well, that's great. That's what it's all. Isn't it wonderful that a guest feels relaxed enough to do that?
Yes.
Yeah.
One of the comments of feedback I've had is that someone who remembers to us events going right back to the 80s, saying that apart from when they were doing autographs or the panel, guests were herded into the green room and they weren't basically allowed to interact with the attendees. And nowadays it's so very, very different because it's not a them and us. Even if it's a new guest like Cammie or Dean, you know, they'll be in the bar getting a drink and they'll happily talk to you and whatever else, and that's the relaxed atmosphere that I've always wanted from the Capitol, and I think we've clearly managed to get that, so that's lovely. But there we are.
How did the Saturday evening finale go? Because we were at McDonald's for that.
It went really well. By the time we were due to start, we were on time. I'd been getting all the auction things finalised. There were At 8:15, I counted about 130 people in the Panopticon by then.
Mm.
It was really well attended, and I think it picked up. And the auction did incredibly well. And then you had Devious Episode 4 world premiere. And then Andrew Beach's sort of AV talk about looking back at the 50th anniversary, that went down really well again, I believe. And that was very well attended. So, yeah, it was a good 2 hours. I only did a bit of it because I tend on the Saturday evening every year to try and just leave it to other people. I've got it set up.
Mm.
Other people can run it. It's a little bit of downtime for me. But, yeah, it was a great success, apparently. I'd been talking to Andrew since the autumn of various possible ideas, and then he threw in this thing about I could do a presentation of this, that and the other, and I thought, yeah, that works. One of the things I wanted was to have as many of those with whom I've been involved since the 1980s. And Andrew, obviously, he took over from me as coordinator in 1987.
I think this year, probably more than any other year, I think we put more effort into trying to capture people for the podcast and hanging around.
You did at least 3 interviews on the Sunday, didn't you?
We did all of the interviews on the Sunday.
So it was like setting them up on the Saturday.
Yeah. Well, we only had one set up by the end of the Saturday. And I'm not being funny. If you'd have said, like, weeks ago, yeah, the only interview you'll have set up by the end of Saturday will be with a bloke who played an android in Time Lash, I'd have been like, oh, no.
You got to meet him and you sent me the interview. But he is just the most wonderful man.
So we were dashing forth between these panels and the bar, getting drinks, as ever, hobnobbing with Gareth Cavanagh and Ian Winston, the Cutaway Comics boys, who are our primary source for the most eye-watering and filthy gossip about Doctor Who history. I actually, like last year, we didn't actually do any of our interviews until the Sunday, did we?
No, there is a lot of trying to set things up on Saturday, isn't there? And then sometimes things come through, sometimes things don't, and that's just the nature of these things. But I tell you what, we did all right on the Sunday.
Didn't we? How did the auction go on for Saturday night, Tony?
It went superbly. With Gift Day, we made over £3,000.
Bloody hell.
I know, it's extraordinary. Wow. There were things were going for great money. Colin Howard's donation of artwork went for £200. Tasha Achilios messaged me on the Saturday morning, said, would you like this of Chris's? There was one of his A3 prints that he signed, and there was something that Peter Davis had signed. Yeah, of course, bring it along. And I changed the order of the, you know, changed what was in the auction again, and that went for 180, and it was just, it was fantastic.
I know our friend Tom from Tom's Refurbishments had supplied you with a Dalek gun, hadn't he, from, was it Remembrance? Is it,
No, it was Revelation.
Revelation, yes.
I put Remembrance when I did the tweet. And I knew it was Revelation. That it was the Revelation because Colin was there.
Mm.
And that made 130, I think.
150, I think.
It all went brilliantly. So lots of money. And still, I'll talk about Alistair's raffle now. That was another record. That was £625 from Alistair's raffle.
Bloody hell.
I know. It's amazing.
What was the price for that? Is that a Colin Baker portrait? Was it a double portrait?
He did a draw. One of them was you didn't have to buy a ticket. You just had to say which of the 9, 10 or however many stories Sylvester had, there is a print of behind this thing. And the answer was Dragonfire. And then so all those who said Dragonfire, it was he tore the little bits of paper up and he drew it out. And that was someone won a lovely print for, you know, didn't even have to buy a ticket. So that's fantastic. But basically, we raised just about £2 per person who was there from the raffle. Extraordinary. I thought the team worked well, actually, because I'd asked Rob Shearman if he'd be willing to be the Dolly Bird as such. And with Martin Parsons and Stephen Cranford, both professionals, doing it as a, that's that one, and sold, and straight to the next. Very good teamwork there.
So Sunday morning, the first panel was the TV movies, Matthew Jacobs.
Yeah, you know how delighted I was from the preview podcast at getting Matthew. And he was lovely. He really warmed into the weekend. His plane landed nearly an hour early from LAX because there was this massive tailwind, the Gulf Stream. So he was at the hotel by 11 on the Friday morning. And we managed to get him a one of the very, very best rooms. And he loved it. And it's just brilliant. Really interesting guest. Really nice guy. And first ever UK convention, and it was, hooray!
I must admit, I was quite offended at being turned out of that room, Tony, but there we are.
Yeah.
That was followed by a panel between Phil Ford, Graham Harper and Gary Russell, of two of whom more later.
Well, it was obviously the basis of the panel was The Waters of Mars, but you've got people who have done so much across Doctor Who. So that worked. And then obviously I caught Graham unawares at the end by presenting him with an outstanding contribution to Doctor Who Award. And as I said, when I did it, I first met Graham nearly 40 years ago and he just won the season 21 Dwas poll for best story for Cage Vandersani, and he got a Sharaz Jack statue. The following year, I presented him with a Davros statue for Revelation of the Daleks. In the intervening decades, he's twice won the poll for best director that the Society has run. So he has received four awards from the Society before, and I thought it was long overdue to present him with an award for his outstanding contribution in The Only Man Who's Directed Classic Who, New Who, Sarah Jane, brilliant director, lovely guy. He said to me in an email afterwards, he said, "I'm really sorry that I didn't show my appreciation in front of the audience to receiving this lovely award. To be really honest, I was completely taken by surprise by you suddenly getting up onto the podium at the end of our session and making your speech and then topping that by presenting me with this award. I was really overwhelmed and was so lost for words. I hardly showed you my real appreciation. Thanks very much to you and your team for thinking of doing it, and I will keep it on my mantelpiece in pride of place for all to see. What a great day for me." And I loved it because his wife, Bernadette, was sitting at the back, almost directly opposite the lectern, and I could see the smile on her face, and she was taking some photos as he was presented with it. So that made me happy, and I think it made great. He deserves it. He's a lovely, lovely guy. And his contribution to Doctor Who and the wider Doctor Who universe has been immense.
He really is. He's such an enthusiastic guy as well, isn't he? He's so happy and eager to talk about it.
And it's because of he was a groundbreaker when he did Caves and Revelation. What he did would show the way that direction would go. You know, he wasn't happy with just doing four or five cameras and going, right, that's camera five, camera two. Da, da. You know, he would go down on the floor. I mean, the crews hated it at the time because it was so new, but he was a groundbreaking director and great man, great man.
And then there's various slipping through interstitial time into autograph rooms and photograph rooms again, followed by the First Doctor panel with John Gurry and Anna Callahan.
Yep.
Verity's PA. What was she like in the end?
Very good. She talked about Verity. That was the thing.
Mm.
She didn't work for Verity when Verity was doing Who, but she worked for Verity for 20 years, knew her like the back of her hand. So she had some interesting stories to tell. And the never-ending question about who directed the episode of Reign of Terror when Henrik Hirsch had his paddy and sort of walked out. Because the rumours over the years and stories have been that it was John Gorry, or it was Tim Coombe, who was AFM or something. And John said, and the reason it's always been covered up with other names, is that Verity Lambert did the direction.
Oh.
And that could not go out in public because the producer suddenly stepping in and doing directing would have gone down very badly at the time with some of those working on the floor, or, you know, the unionized things it was in the 60s. So there was always a bit of grey put into it, but he's certain that Verity did it.
A bit like the Barry Letts thing, isn't it, where you used to write the final story of seasons despite being the producer.
Yeah, but also, for example, by 1970, or when they were filming it, of course, Dougie Canfield had heart trouble, so Barry Letts took over on Inferno, didn't he? But it was never credited. It was always...
Yes, of course, yeah.
Always credited to Dougie, so... It's nice to get the story. I mean, John is 90 years old. What an incredible man.
Hmm.
Just unbelievable. You would not think that he was... You would think he's in his 70s. Lucid, mobile. I mean, if any of us make it to 90, I hope we're like that and not gibbering heaps. And given that we're gibbering heaps now when we're much younger.
Well, I was going to say, people say the thing about the 70s with regards to me, but...
So that was lovely. Again, it was one thing I wasn't going to do was have, you know, 13 panels, but we were going to start with the First Doctor, then Second Doctor, then Third Doctor. So we were jumping around between New Who, Classic Who, starting off with the movie. The strange thing was that the Sunday afternoon, the way it worked out, you had the First Doctor panel and then the Second Doctor panel back to back. But there's no problem with that. And Fraser and Wendy were obviously on top form. I mean, they're just they've been working together a lot recently, but it's a dream team. They're so good together. And their working relationship, the two of them with Patrick Troughton, was fantastic. And that still comes right across.
Yes, I think there's more on that later as well, isn't there?
Is there?
Oh, yes, of which more to come. That's followed by a Ninth Doctor panel with Annette Badland, Eric Potts and Rob Sherman.
How lovely is Annette Badland as well?
She is fantastic. It's the first time I'd met her. I actually made myself in the green room on the Sunday afternoon. I made myself sit down. I wanted to talk to Eric because he's a maestro at Panto and I used to do all my Panto stuff.
Right.
And it was interesting to compare notes. And I wanted to talk to Annette and she is absolutely gorgeous. And I had 15, 20 minutes where I just talked to them. And this is very unusual, but I made myself the time. Fascinating. We talked about all sorts of things, the ridiculous price of tickets for theatres and things like that nowadays, Annette's career and this and that. And she glows, doesn't she?
She does. I bumped into her in the corridor and she's the one person that I said to her, she was being escorted around by a new member of staff this year called Beef.
Beef!
Yeah, the magnificent Beef was there working for you, wasn't he? And I did stop. I couldn't help but nab a quick selfie with it, which is pretty much the only sort of fan service thing I did pretty much all weekend. And it was...
Just about comes up to your elbow, doesn't she, Mark?
Well, yeah, but you're absolutely right, Tony, when you say she glows. She has this aura, and I think in the photo of me, you can see me standing there, I'm like, I actually look starstruck. I'm like, oh!
If you actually look at her CV, what she's done on stage, television, film, it is incredible. And she's still working really hard. And I know when we booked her, it was a case of she could actually make this weekend because most other weekends she's working. So we were in luck. That's what I said to you earlier, wasn't it? The guests could make it and it all came together. Mm. And originally I was going to have a Slitheen panel. And then Rob Sherman is an old friend and he's such a lovely guy. And I thought, let's get Rob involved because then we've got episodes 4, 5 and 6 of Eccleston's one season there. And I know Rob was at the original read-through for Aliens of London. There were a lot of people who were working on series one were there.
Yes.
So there was a natural, you know, they could come together. So it worked beautifully, absolutely beautifully.
And rounded off by the final panel with...
John Leeson.
Louise Jameson. Yes. John Leeson and someone called Louise Jameson.
She's another, I mean... It's 4 years since she was at the Capitol.
Yeah.
Obviously, we missed out on 2 years. And she just walks in and you just go, wow. Oh. You do.
She is so glamorous, isn't she? There's a line in the West Wing where they talk about CJ being like a 50s movie star. And she isn't she? Not in the sense that she looks like she's from the 50s, but, you know, a proper glamorous star.
And she's another one, like Annette. She, you know, she's got an extension on her contract for Emmerdale till next year. You know, she was in Enders for some years as Rosa DeMarco, whatever. A woman who basically never stops working. And when the TV isn't, she's not doing TV, then she's happy to do much lower key theatre work, which is she values as much as the TV. Obviously, the TV pays the money, but she's never not working. And she does loads of Big Finish and stuff. And she's just gorgeous.
Yeah, and still, when you see her walking around, first time I saw her again this year and she walked in, first time I set eyes on her, it's that thing. Do you remember when we met her at the previous, at the Capitol she was at before?
Mm.
We got to the table there. Her eyes, it's just, I don't know, it's just, they're ageless somehow. It's just, she's just got this, she's another one of these people who's quite magnetic, isn't she? She just has
totally
something.
I think she really appreciates and values the fans. And those who've been around and doing conventions for the decades, they do.
Mm.
For example, Katie's another one.
Yeah.
Fraser, they all know what they mean to the fans, but they know what the fans mean to them, become part of their life.
She was going around sitting down with some of the fans, and I noticed, and she sat down with a mum who had her young lad with her, and clearly the young lad was a huge Doctor Who fan, because the way he was just staring at Louise Jameson, he's sort of half blushing, and he must have been about 9 or 10, I guess, and you know, she went and sat down, she was chatting to him, and you could tell he was totally starstruck as well. But it's just lovely the fact that she took her time out just to sit down and talk to like this 10-year-old fan in the bar and stuff. And she sat there for quite a while chatting with them, and it was and with other people
this
as well.
This goes back to what I was saying earlier. Yeah, it's lovely. Not like the 80s where it was, we'll hide them away, it's them and us. No. The guests are very happy to mingle with the attendees, and it makes for a great atmosphere. But it was wonderful that final afternoon. You think you had Annette and then you had Louise. You had two gorgeous ladies who are both in their 70s and just look fantastic. But then if you go to the Dwas Facebook page, there's two videos up from the weekend that I think Robbie Dunlop took. There's Stephen Moffat getting his Terence Award, but the longer one is John Leeson receiving his Outstanding Contribution to Doctor Who Award. I came up, said my spiel, and then Louise was in on it, and I said, I'd like to ask Louise to present you with this award. And John was so emotional. Were you in there for that?
No, we were doing an interview.
He was overwhelmed by it. It was a genuinely beautiful moment. And it was like, wow. And his wife had recently, Judy, just earlier this year, received a Lifetime Contribution to Set Designers Award. So for him to get this, and we didn't know that, obviously, just within months of her getting that, he was just taken aback. And it was the most glorious way to finish the weekend, quite frankly. It made my heart glow, you know, that he was so pleased.
And so then in the end, on Sunday, we had interviews with Dean Hollingsworth, ostensibly just the androids on Timelash, but so much more.
Yes.
You understand now why, having met him, I invited him as a guest.
He's a great guy. He's a great guy. He was lovely. He was another one who was walking around just happy to chat to people and socialising. And he clearly enjoyed himself. He was there both days for almost the entire time. And he looks really happy. And his wife's amazing as well. Yeah, she's a force of nature.
She really is, isn't she? Now, they flew in on Friday afternoon. They got because they live on Guernsey, and they got the last flight back on the Sunday evenings. And that was the point. Basically, they were just, it was nice for them to have a week. They'd celebrated her birthday the previous weekend in Dublin, and this weekend they were in Crawley.
Oh, it doesn't get better than that.
He came up to us in the bar and said, I'd like to do an interview with you. What do you want to talk about? And we were explaining that we tend to have a horror of doing these interviews and saying, oh, tell us how exciting it was to be in Doctor Who. So he said, oh, you know, anything you'd like to talk about, we're fine. So he said, I could talk to you about how I got Chris Eccleston's equity card.
Yeah, I heard that story from him when we were getting driven from Kassel to Frankfurt after our flight had been cancelled going home from Timelash last year. And the trouble is, he was telling me this story and I had the most dreadful hangover. So it went in one ear and out the other.
We were fortified this year by having Hayden with us, who quite blithely is prepared to fit in and out of the green room, which Mark and I are far too self-effacing to do. We also interviewed as a pair the great, the great Gary Russell and the great Phil Ford, who went into a lot more detail with us about the extent of work that showrunners like Russell do, travails of the showrunner.
Yeah, that will be interesting.
We'll have to warn you, listeners, that, shall we say, the audio quality might be interesting. Because, of course, we had one mic with a single audio track. And so when we're getting more and more excited, we start talking over each other. And when there's five of us in the room, the bits where we talk over each other become slightly inaudible, but there we are.
Can I just say, first time I'd met Phil, delighted I invited him. Another fantastic guy.
Yeah.
He's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, lovely guy, really good. I mean, I think sometimes I think certain interviews with us, you need a sense of humour to be
yes.
get through the interviews with us. And they're both very patient, very funny, and very accommodating, both Phil Ford and Gary Russell. So we're really lucky with that.
When I told Gary that I was inviting Phil, or I had invited Phil, he was delighted. When they were working together in Cardiff in the late noughties and early teens, I think they got on like a house on fire. So I know that both were really looking forward to doing the panel, especially with Graham as well. It was like a dream panel for them.
And if Hayden being able to flit in and out of the green room was useful to our obtaining interviews, it was paled into insignificance next to how useful it is now that Mark started smoking again.
Who did you meet outside this year?
Oh, the glorious Wendy.
Yes.
Oh, yes, of course, Padders does. And John Davey does. I know he does.
We fell a little bit in love with Wendy.
Only a little bit.
Well, I did that a long time ago, but there we are. I think I did that when I was about 10, actually.
I think we actually specifically talked a lot about the, unusually for us, about the stories. You know, we talked about Invasion.
Mind Robber.
And War Games and that. And you talked about your theories about the end of childhood, didn't you? At the end of the 60s.
Yes. And Hayden tying it in with the end of the 60s, yeah.
And then, if we fell in love with the warmth and friendliness of Wendy, that was nothing compared with what happened when we managed to crowbar Mr. Sherman into the interview room. Did we get the Cutaway Comics boys to kidnap him? We did, didn't we?
No, that was me again, I think.
Was it? Oh, right.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't forget, Rob knew you from Terrence, yeah. Didn't he? So.
That's more of a con than a pro, Tony.
That was me again. I mean, I don't mean to blow my own trumpet, but I think I got every single one of those interviews apart from the Dean Hollingsworth. So I had a great...
This is Mark saying, I don't mean to blow my own trumpet, but... Da-da-da-da!
But I am, yeah. I was just in the right place at the right time, that's all.
I mean, he was... I don't know why we're saying, oh, how surprising that they turned out to be lovely, because...
No.
Why wouldn't they be? They're not going to be going to be rude, are they?
I'll tell you who was lovely as well. I hadn't seen her since The Capitol 2. Wendy's daughter, Charlie Hayes, was with her as well. And she's lovely as well.
Yes, yeah.
I've got to try and find a way to get her back to another Capitol.
And if talking over each other was a lot there, that again pales into significance against the interview that we did for the Cutaway Comics Boys Cutaway Bunker podcast.
Oh, they have a podcast, do they? Oh.
Which lasted God knows how long. And involved all three of us and Ian and Gareth. Links in the show notes, of course, at dudleydumpodcast.wordpress.com.
Can I just say, by the way, our final choice, which I'm not going to say what it is yet, but our final choice for the Cutaway Bunker, because you have to pick five Doctor Who stories or things that are going to entertain you whilst the apocalypse is happening outside. And you can only take five of these Doctor Who things into the bunker with you. Our final choice was rather hurried by the fact that I think it had reached 10 to 11 and the bar was about to close. So I think we totally said, somebody suggested a story and I think we basically, I was like looking at my watch thinking, yeah, that's great. Yeah, let's do that.
We spent a lot of time with Tom from Tom's Refurbishments.
Tom was also the man who got us...
The Black Dalek?
Yeah.
That's very funny.
I can't remember who brought us the other lovely 60s Dalek. Oh, this is a true story. I was interviewing Katie on the Saturday afternoon, yeah?
Mm.
And I was to her right, and I must have looked at her, I don't know how many times, and about 20 minutes in, I suddenly said, it's a Dalek over there. Where did that come from? It was not there when we started. I had not noticed it. And it was like, wow. And yes, Dalek, I can't remember his name now. The name they give it. Ian's the guy who brought it. He lives in Western Supermare. He's a train driver for GWR and his shifts worked out that he could bring it. So he came up on the Sunday morning. Tom had been talking about him in emails with me for several months and he was there on the Sunday morning and he was polishing the Dalek and it was absolute. It was beautiful, wasn't it?
It's shiny and lovely.
Mm, gleaming.
Yeah. And it's got the lights underneath as though, so you think it's, you know, it could be going upstairs or whatever. It was just wonderful. It was lovely. And it really got people talking as well. You can't go wrong. It's Dalek Draco. That's its name. Dalek yes. Draco. You cannot go wrong having a Dalek going around through a hotel bar. So it's given me ideas for next year. So we'll see what happens.
It was very reminiscent of Staircase of the Daleks, wasn't it, at the Aurora?
Lift shafts.
Lift shafts of the Daleks, that was it.
We had a couple of, the one Dalek last year, but you can't go wrong. You see a Dalek, people say, can I have a photo with it, don't they? It's just what you do. It's interesting to compare the height of the Cult of Skaro Dalek and the 60s Dalek from Master Plan or whatever. I mean, there's about a foot shorter, the old ones, weren't they?
Yes. Yeah, well, because they were on the level with William Hartnell, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly. And nowadays, you know, someone like Nick Pegg can get it, and he's about the same height as me, 6'2", 6'3", so very different. Well, that was a nice little addition, and we hadn't said anything about it, and people enjoyed it. So all these things, I have to say, however much I might plan an event, everything came together.
Mm.
And you can't. If someone cries off ill, you can't do anything about it. The unexpected, you know, the Dalek turned up. No one would have expected it. The hotel did the business. Everything gelled. And there's an element of luck in that happening. But it did, and so I'm very grateful.
Yes, it was Dalek Draco. Built by Ian and Tracy McTeague, who hail from the Daleks of Somerset Group. Ian and Tracy apparently built the Dalek from scratch, and Tom later refurbished it, the appendages and the internal wiring. Dalek Draco is one of three Daleks owned by Ian and Tracy, including Dalek Bowen, who's a white paradigm supreme Dalek, and Dalek Wolf, which is one of the first Daleks Tom was asked to refurbish about 8 years ago. We had a very interesting long conversation in the bar with Lisa, who is the partner of Hugh, who was the double brigadier last year.
Yes, and he was Tom on Saturday and Patrick on Sunday, wasn't he, this year?
Yeah.
Lisa cornered us, demanding to know why it was that so many men, both the fans and the Dwas helpers, managed to attend these events. It's because the women are staying at home and looking after the kids and that. And she was saying, why can't it be the other way around?
Well, I have to say that Mrs. J was at home looking after the cats.
Anyway, we promised Lisa that we'd mention this as our passport to safety. So, I seem to remember that a couple of days ago you announced how much you made in the end for charity.
Yes, it was staggering. £6,556. Now, that even beats what we raised at the Terence Day, which was 6,100 odd. What I can do is I will just look and say that for the six capitals and the Terence Day combined, so that's seven events, we have raised £29,662, which is staggering.
Yeah, that's great.
And this year, that's going to what? Parkinson's?
Parkinson's, prostate cancer, and Centrepoint. And the majority is going to Parkinson's because Stephen said he'd like his what he does to go to Parkinson's. And one of the raffle, one of the auction prizes Alistair had was something signed by Peter Davison, and he said, could it go to Centrepoint because that's a charity that Peter supports. So there's no problem with that at all. But it is a staggering. This is, again, it was like everything came together so that we raised money that could never conceivably have hoped of. And it just, you know, it was one of those weekends where everything went for us. There'll be other conventions that it doesn't always go. Last year, everyone enjoyed, but there were things that weren't so right. And obviously, who knows what will happen next year when we're in a new, completely new venue. But that's one of the reasons I went to visit it yesterday. And I'll go there every couple of months, probably, because I just want to make sure that they know what I would like.
So that's going to be in Birmingham, isn't it?
It's not in Birmingham.
Oh.
Well, okay, it calls itself the Holiday Inn Birmingham M6 Junction 7. It has got a B postcode, a B43 postcode. It's outside of the centre of Birmingham. It's actually in an area called Great Bar. Not far from Perry Bar, which is where the Commonwealth Games Stadium, the Alexander Stadium, is. So if you're driving, it is 1 minute from Junction 7 of the M6. There are ways and means of getting there by public transport. The good news is that Birmingham New Street is served by so many different lines and whatever. And once you get into New Street, you can get a connecting train to Hampstead Station, which is 2 miles away, and then get a cab or you can get a 51 bus from just up the road from New Street. They'll take you right to outside the venue. So it's accessible. And I'm optimistic for next year. At the meeting yesterday, I explained, well, how about this? How about that? I've got this idea. Can you do this? Can you do that? I was checking out their AV potentials because the Crown Plaza's kit is very, very old. So, yeah, we're working on it. And fingers crossed for the 27th and 28th of April, 2024. It's got a pool as well. It's got a leisure club and a pool there.
Wow.
So that'll be interesting.
So once again, thanks from the Diddly Dummers to Tony and his, do I mean consigliere? I don't, do I? And his gang of Dwas helpers.
Can I also just say, yeah, especially Barry and Patrick as well, who are both like incredibly helpful with us when we're trying to get to talk to people and trying to get to when we were trying to find people and and work out what we were doing. And also thanks to Andrea as well, who's a firm friend of the podcast and who we're always delighted to see at these...
TARDIS Parrot, you mean?
Yes, she's great. Yeah. It's lovely to...
She's hopeful that she'll be able to make it to Birmingham next year.
I do hope so. So that sounds good. Because I do find she's... Sometimes I, like many people who attend these things, anxiety can sometimes be a problem, and sometimes you can feel it running up. It was nice when you've been inside all day, you've been trying to sort things out, or you've been in panels, things can start feeling a bit kind of on top of you. You can feel your head going and melting a bit. And it was lovely just to be able to sit down with her and just get back on, you know, touch the floor again and just like, and relax and see. So, yeah, thanks for that.
Although I front it, I couldn't do any of this without the team. And as I said on the Sunday night, since I first came up with the idea of the Capitol in 2015, many of the team have been doing things with me on behalf of the DWAS for many years longer than that. And you can't, you rely on people who sit and sit with the autograph signers, who direct people where to go, the interviewers, Robin and his team, Tom Jedski, who films it for us. There's so many, and you don't always see what they're doing, but they're essential. The total team, including everything, is like 25 people. They're essential. They're invaluable. A couple of my team, I asked them if they would. They went and collected people from airports or from London or whatever. It was absolutely fantastic. I can't speak highly enough of them. And they're all enthusiastic, and they're just great. They're really great. I'll say no more.
I was even, and the listeners will no doubt be gasping in awe at the sheer bravery of this. I was even having chats with the coordinator himself, Paul.
To do my will shall be the whole of the law.
Winter, and I'm sure the listeners will be thinking, how did Paul pluck up the confidence to approach the Diddly Dummers? But there we are.
He was stuck by the entrance all weekend, basically, so he couldn't get away from you.
Poor Paul.
He does a brilliant job, and his work behind the scenes in terms of, you know, the whole year round, taking the bookings online, emailing attendees, and emailing them again, getting all the packs together and posting them out. I couldn't do it all. It's impossible. So the work he put in was fantastic. But as you said, Barry, Patrick, everyone is just great. And you can see that it's a team, can't you? You can genuinely feel that everyone is working for the greater good.
Mm. Paul and I work at extremely divergent levels in the same organisation, so it's always good to have a moan every now and again, every time I see him once a year. Oh, what's been happening? Oh, you're involved in that, are you? Oh, God.
Yeah, I'm sure that is the case, I have no doubt.
But we would like to say, Tony, and I know you're going to be surprised by this, but given that this is now the fourth year, I think, at which the Diddly Dum podcast has been the official podcast of the DWAS Capitol Convention, we would like to present you with an award for your contribution to Diddly Dum podcasting. And so I'll just let this glass award. Mark, could you just take it and pass it to Tony, please? No, hang on. Be careful. Can we get someone to sweep this up, please? Matt, yeah, it's okay. Matt Stevens is going to come along and sweep it up. Oh, careful, Matt. Don't break it.
It's already in 1,000 pieces. That's the nearest I've ever got to getting an award.
And you were just summoning up the tears, weren't you, Tony?
It's a good job that you've cut out me blubbing.
So, I think what we will do is, once again, Tony, many thanks. I know we say this all the time, but I don't think we have yet reached the point where we're becoming blasé about it. Still astonishes us that you want us anywhere near anything that you're doing. I think we'll, next one, when Bugalugs is back, we'll talk about some of the individual people. We had long chats with Tasha, didn't we, Mark, at the bar?
She's a lovely lady as well.
Beef has become a good friend. We only met him last year. We've gone from a time where, in the first year at the Aurora, and Mark and I just used to sit in the bar, just hoping that no one would notice us, to this year where Beef is standing at the bar, he just swings round. We're at the absolute far end of the bar, and he roars across the bar, "Hello, Diddly Dum!" we weren't in the least bit embarrassed, were we, Mark?
That's Beef down to a T. I first met Beef, as with so many people, or lots of people who come to the capital now, in Germany in 2019. And that's where I first met Howard Hayes. That's where I first met Amy. I first met Beef. Obviously, I first met Dean at the last year's one. I've made some really good friends from there, and it's nice that they're coming to the capital, you know. And it was so fantastic, can I just say, that Elena managed to get in from Moscow and spend the weekend with us. Our friend from Moscow, who was at the first four capitals, that was a joy. We'd spent a lot of time working on that, myself and Howard Hayes, getting her over and the issues of it. And it was a delight. And she, I know, I could see her face change from when she first got there and through the weekend, just smile on it. She was so happy to be there. So happy to be there, and it was a delight that she was with us. And I was so thrilled that she managed to get to Gatwick from Mokba via Istanbul. But we have people coming from all over the world, so it's fantastic for me that the name of the capital has spread across Europe and across to North America. So someone from Canada, two people came from Australia. It's brilliant. It's so life affirming.
Beef's dad, see, that's the old chap who was cosplaying as the first Doctor last year.
He was cosplaying his first Doctor in the first capital I went to, which was number two. And I remember the first time I saw him was I was stood in the toilet at the urinals, and suddenly this figure appeared next to me. I turned around and I had to do a double take because it's like, what?
the first time I went to Castle in 2019 for Time Lash, Deutsche Bahn trains were all up to shoot. And I was on the same platform with Beef's dad, who was travelling as William Hartnell. At this station in the middle of Germany, and it was very surreal.
So, once again, thanks to Tony and his DWAS colleagues. What we'll do, we will add to the end of this podcast our first interview, which was with Dean Hollingsworth on the Sunday, and which is very good. It's almost a Tony-orientated interview. If only we could have managed to find out that he'd done some panto work, Tony would have been over the moon as well. Who's this coming down the corridor to say goodbye to us? Oh, it's Uncle Brucey. Uncle Brucey, how are you?
Life is the name of the game, and I want to play a game with you.
Given how many times the three of us crossed and recrossed the Thames getting to and from Capital this month, Brucey, have you got anything to tell us about keeping the country's inland waterways fresh from sewage and disease?
Yes, I certainly have. Mark, don't throw your dirty fagbats in the river. Into the river, don't dump your dirty fagbats.
Uncle Brucey, we have Dwas head honchos heading quickly for the door.
It's a buffet.
Bye, everyone. Stay listening for our Dean Hollingsworth interview, listeners, coming up now.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, goodbye. Till the next time.
Capital, 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 capital.
Right, listeners, we're at Capital 6. We're here with Dean Hollingsworth. Fame. For playing the various androids in Time Lash. Fame for being the bus conductor in The Greatest Show in the Galaxy. Fame for so many other things. But we've all been an android in Time Lash in our time. But we can't all claim to have played critical roles in the career of the Ninth Doctor, can we?
No, that's...
Dean, I understand you've known Chris Eccleston for a while.
Well, yeah. Chris was a student at Central School of Speech and Drama, and he was in the year below me. I left in 1984. Chris left in 1985. And the story goes that I left Central a term early because I got offered a job at Westcliff, and there was an equity card that went with it. So in those days, you couldn't work as an actor, professional actor, unless you had an equity card. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't get an equity card unless you were offered some work. So,
catch 22.
Exactly. You could probably spot the catch 22 in that little scenario. Mm-hmm. So, if you were offered a card, it was quite it's a real opportunity to get into the business. And without it, you just couldn't get in. It was that simple. It was a closed shop. So off I went to Westcliff. And so, this is going to be a little bit of a longer story, by the way. I hope you don't mind.
Shut away.
Okay, great. So, off I go to Westcliff, and I do a couple of kids. touring plays around West Cliff, and then I go into the main house and do Lark Rise with the guys there. And one of the guys I was working with on the Palace Go Round children's tour was a guy called Tim Raynham. Now, Tim, while we were doing the show, managed to get a gig on Doctor Who as a Sontaran with Sarah Hellings in probably the episode prior to retirement. So I wrote to Sarah Hellings. No, actually, I got drunk. And I told this story many, many times, but I got drunk. And I wrote a letter saying that I'd always wanted to be in Doctor Who. I'd been practicing in my dustbin with an egg whisk and a toilet plunger. And I think I've got the Dalek pretty well now. And she wrote back to me, oh, yeah, no, I sent it before I sobered up. Because I wouldn't have sent it if I'd have waited till the following morning, you know, because she don't do that. It's not unprofessional to send anything that's funny, you know, asking for work. So anyway, she sent a lovely letter back, and she said, oh, we really enjoyed your letter. We thought it was very funny. Unfortunately, we've finished casting now, but Pennant Roberts is casting the next one, so perhaps if you write to him. So being very cheeky, I wrote to Pennant saying, Sarah Hellings suggested I write to you.
Which is true.
No. Anyway, he called me in, and the rest is history. I ended up in Time Lash. So I did that, and I was out of work for a little while. And one of my friends from drama school rang me up and said, one of the teachers has to do a little scene for her graduation. And she thinks that if she gets some of the actors from Central to do it, she'd probably get more chance of actually getting a better grade. Because then all she's got to do is sit back and let us do it and do all the work. So I rock up, and we're doing this scene from Volpone. And Steve Casey, who was in my year at Central, and a young actor who had just come out of drama school called Hugh Bonneville. So Hugh turns to me while we're rehearsing. We'd got on really well. He was Richard in those days. That's how I know him as Richard. Because he changed his name later. So we really got on really well. He played all the Corbaccio and Corvoni characters. I played Volpone. And we just had a ball of laugh. And it was great fun. And she got her graduation thing. Anyway, while we were doing it, Hugh said to me, are you interested in doing some Shakespeare workshops? So I said, yeah, definitely. Because I'd been doing these in Guernsey, so I wanted to do some as well. So he invited me along to this company called Syllabus Productions. And there was Hugh, another actor called Lloyd Owen. I don't know, have you seen Rings of Power?
The Tolkien.
To Tolkien, yeah. He's the Admiral, the guy that almost the big character.
Man, that's interesting. I'll check online what you're because that brings about that.
Yeah. So Lloyd was there as well. So we did these sort of Shakespeare thing. We were all students out of drama school, trying to get work, trying to, you know, keep the wolf from the door, that sort of thing. And as luck would have it, they decided that the woman that ran it had some health problems, and she said, would you like to take over the running of it? So I said, well, okay. But there were two equity cards that went with the theatre company. And I thought, well, actually, this is quite a good opportunity because, A, I love introducing kids to Shakespeare, and B, it's a professional gig, so therefore I can maybe work with mates that I want to work with while we're waiting for other work and stuff. It keeps our hand in because obviously we're practicing, we're doing our Shakespeare and stuff, which you can't get as a young actor. It's impossible to get any sort of stuff like that. And then, and of course, the two equity cards. So off we went, and we were doing that for a little while. And then I got a job at the National Theatre with Richard Eyre's first company in Bartholomew Fair, and then on with Hamlet with Judy Dench and Daniel Day-Lewis. And while I was there, I said to Helen Patrick, who later became the young Nora Batty in First of the Summer Wine. That was her. So she was in Chris's year, and we were doing a workshop on Charles Dickens, and we hadn't done a Charles Dickens one before. Anyway, she turned to me and she said, should we get Chris to come in? Because Chris has not been working. And I said, well, this was about 1988, I think. And I said, Chris hasn't been working since 2 years, for 2 years or 3 years. I said, no, he can't get work. He can't get his cards. We'd already used our cards up. So I said, oh, that's really, you know. Anyway, he came down. I said to Chris, look, you can come down, but we'll pay you. But it'll be a non sort of, it's a one-off workshop, so it's not part of a long contract. So we pay you, but we can't do anything via the cards thing. So anyway, off we went, and we did this workshop. And the extraordinary thing was, and I was saying to Chris yesterday, he was playing, the way we did it was we wanted to show Dickens in various kind of scenarios. So as a reading, you know, have Henry Dickens read to you, which is how it was originally done, serialized. And then as a radio, so we asked them all to close their eyes and imagine they're listening to it on the radio. And then we did a little Dickens play, which he wrote plays, they weren't very good, but we did a play of his. And it was just to show the different forms you could express, you know, writing with. And at the end of it, I've never seen it. You know, we probably introduced 50,000 children to Shakespeare in workshops for 15 years.
Wow.
Only time that an actor that I brought in has been mobbed by the students, well, girls mostly, I have to say, it was girls' school, asking for autographs for an actor who was totally and utterly unknown and hadn't even done any professional work yet. And I thought that was extraordinary. He must have some incredible quality to be able to make a connection with audiences that strong. So I was kind of a bit impressed by that, as well as obviously knowing Chris's work and seeing him act. So I knew he was a superb actor, a really extraordinary actor, actually. Anyway, I was at the National, got a phone call from Helen, and Helen said, we've got this next contract coming up. We've got two cards to hand out this year. This was in 89. She said, can we give one to Chris? And didn't even have to, on a heartbeat, it was, of course. You know, this is exactly why we have cards to give out. It's to give out to people who've done 3 years training, just can't get into the industry, and we recognise them as colleagues that they need to be in here and with us and doing the work they do. So 1989, we gave him a three-week contract, and on he came and did 3 weeks, and we handed him his provisional card. And as they say, the rest is history. He very soon after that was able to do things like Let Him Have It and
Shallow Grave.
What a wonderful film that was.
Gosh, that was the first time I came across it.
Yeah, and what was the other thing he did there? Our Friends in the North with Daniel Craig, and then he did, you know, Hamlet and Macbeth and Dickens, you know. And there's a part of me that sort of goes, oh, God, Chris has done, you know, has veered towards Shakespeare and Dickens. And it's like, that's kind of how we first learned that. Yes. And, you know, my favourite film is It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh,
because
yes.
of the whole kind of everyone changes the world and everyone has, you know, makes a contribution, and everyone has, you know, if you're friends and that, you're not failing. And there's a part of me that always thinks that, you know, if we hadn't have done that, I wonder how long Chris might have held out, because he was, I think, getting to the end of his tether in terms of, because he was in the supermarkets, I think, just trying to get work and arrive and that. But I met him a few years later at the Green Room Club after he had the success, you know. And I mentioned to him, I said, oh, Chris, you know, lovely to see you. And I think he was still kind of, his head was still trying to get around the huge seismic change that had happened. So I said to him, it's really good to see you getting on really well, you know. And he said, I'll keep the wolf from the door. That's the sort of northern,
yes.
you know, self-deprecating. And, of course, I'd been in Doctor Who, and he had made a couple of comments that he wasn't a big fan, which was a bit of a strange kind of thing. Because I was surprised later when he then applied, or he went to Russell T. But then I've listened to him talk. And, of course, the thing with him is that he worked with Russell on that previous
Second Coming.
And that was the sort of, he wanted to work with Russell. And I think he was interested in the writing of, you know, that Russell had and that. And Chris, I think the thing with Chris is that he's such an exciting person to work with, because he's, you know, he's constantly challenging his world. He's constantly getting into his uncomfortable zone. So it for me, it was actually probably par for the course that he would take something that he didn't like by prejudice go, you know, I'm going to have a go at that and see what happens. And he's done that with conventions. I know that he started off by not, he was, I think, one of the only doctors that wouldn't go to any of the conventions. And then I noticed he started popping up recently, and I thought, oh, good for you, because now you get it, because I didn't get it. I was avoiding them right from the start and say, I'm not going to do any of that sort of fandom. I'm not going to get into it at all. It's because it's all very sort of, you know, the fame and that. It's nothing to do with the acting and that. But actually, it's not about us, the actors. It's about, you know, the fans and the thing. And And it's also, and I was talking to some people yesterday at the signings where I was saying, do you know, it's so good for me to be able to talk to you, because when I did this, it was, what, 1984?
Mm.
And you do it to a glass lens, and the technicians are not interested in what you're doing because they're doing the lighting and the sound. And the so you've got no connection with the people, your audience, at all. And then it gets broadcast, you know, months later. Mm. So you get no idea apart from the, maybe reviews or whatever it is. So actually I was cutting myself off from that conversation with the audience of it. So I wasn't really getting any kind of understanding about whether it was any good or not, mm. what they thought, you know. So, of course, the received thing was that Time Lash was a terrible show, and, you know, so I was thinking, oh, dear, you know. But now, when I'm actually talking to people,
yes.
they're actually coming up to me and saying, I really like Time Lash. Yeah, yeah. And when you get it that word of mouth rather than from the newspapers or from a critic or whatever, then suddenly it's a different vibe. Mm. It's the same thing as when you do a theatre play and you hear a big laugh.
Yeah.
And the audience love it, and then you read in the paper next day, oh, this is rubbish and stuff. And you think, yeah, well, that critic is obviously...
I was going to say that, because I think I've also thought it must be like a bit like being a stand-up comedian. You know you've been successful, don't you? Because you hear the laughs. And I imagine that regardless of what sort of play you're doing on the stage,
yeah.
it doesn't have to be comic, you get vibes back from the audience, even if it's not vocal ones.
I did Comedians many years ago. Paul McGann, I think, played.
I guess everywhere these doctors.
Yeah, yeah. I saw him.
McGann's like,
yeah. I think I saw Paul McGann in Comedians at the Young Vic, and I played it when I was about 19 in my local youth theatre. And like you say, it doesn't have to be comedy, although it's Comedians and it's, but you know, there's a bit where he does some comedy, and it's not funny, but it's almost embarrassing. But there's a silence that an audience can give you that is almost as powerful as a belly laugh. And that is as much a buzz that you can get when you change the atmosphere of a room from doing something that is, you know, quite powerful. So you're right. Richard Eyre was doing a platform, and someone asked him, said, what's the difference between television and theatre? And I thought his response was brilliant. He said, theatre is unlike film and television in that television film are voyeuristic, where the viewer is watching the actor in a different space in a different time.
And the actor's unaware.
Unaware of the reaction of, yeah. yeah. Whereas theatre is a conversation.
Mm.
And I love that. Definitely.
Yeah, that's interesting.
There has been, I think, recently with, was it the Tim Turner West End musical? Would be. The audience was singing back.
No, it's the Bodyguard.
The Bodyguard.
Oh, the Bodyguard.
Yeah. I will always love you.
Which is,
I'm never going to forget that.
Which is
very good.
Yeah, yeah. It's like that, but with a tune.
Yeah. all these years. That explains my karaoke appearances.
I think you've actually really shown us all why it was banned now.
You showed us where you wanted to.
That's exactly why I did it like that. Obviously, if I was doing it myself, properly,
yeah, exactly.
It would have sounded wonderful. Yes. But
so I presume that was overstepping, not Mark's.
I'm overstepping
the mark with that rendition, but when they did that was the...
I feel I may have done.
Breaking through that fourth wall too much.
Yeah, so, yeah. There is that. But, you know, as actors, we're supposed to, you know, somehow zone all that out.
Right.
Having said that... My English teacher, he was very funny. He was from the north, from Grantham. And he's, you know, he said, it's ridiculous nowadays. He said, I went to the theatre the other day, and he said, someone in the middle of an act got up and went to the toilet. He said, that's ridiculous. Why don't they wait until the interval? And then there's mobile phones going off, you know, in the middle of shows and stuff, which we're not supposed to react to. Although I was doing Dad's Army once, and George... George was playing, what's his name? Clive Dunpart.
Oh, yeah. Corporal Jones.
Corporal Jones, that's it. And we were doing this, and someone's mobile phone went off in the audience. And George broke out of the scene and just went, oh, Captain Menner, it's one of those Zeppelins. So, yeah, sometimes it works to your favour, sometimes not. But yeah, and you know, you will get that. When I was at the National, we went to Hong Kong and opened the cultural center there. And then we went on to Tokyo and played at the Tokyo Globe. This was before we built our Globe. In fact, the joke at the time was the Japanese tore down a car park to build a Globe, whereas we tore down the Globe to build a car park. So, yeah, we were in Tokyo, and they warned us beforehand, said, be aware that the Japanese are big fans of Shakespeare, and they use Shakespeare to learn English. But what you will hear is a very strange sound every 2 minutes, which is shh. And it is the sound of 2,000 people turning the page on their script.
Oh, they're reading it through.
While you're speaking.
I often hear rock bands and people who go along to Tokyo and stuff to play concerts, and the audience will sit there and they just sit and they're very polite. Yes. And they'll wait for an appropriate moment to do a very polite applause, but there'll be no, obviously, what concerts over here, people are just going nuts the whole time. And so, where they just go over there and everyone just sits there very politely going, I'm really enjoying this.
You in particular, Mark. You shouting at, who was it? Alice Cooper concert. Hang him.
Well, you know, that was just part of the vibe. So, yes.
So, forgive me for straying back to Yachtover, but when you're playing that android with a mask on, well, you've always doubly got a barrier between yourself and...
Well, the thing with the Time Lash android was that they'd run out of money because they'd spent it all on the Spanish trip with Tim Rayner, who'd gone over there for some time. And so we had a lot of money, as you probably noticed from the set, which kept falling off, because knobs kept falling off, and... And of course, the tinsel inside the Time Lash.
I did think that graffiti on the set of John Pertwee was completely. Who left that there?
I know, that was weird.
Yeah.
But that was my opportunity to have a photograph taken with Colin and John Pertwee at the same time. So I've got that in my phone, and it's rather nice to be able to have two doctors in your photograph.
I remember the Lloyd Owen reference. I was thinking, wow, what made you think of that? Because I was watching Rings of Power.
Yeah.
I wasn't enjoying it much, but I was doing that thing where sometimes the less you enjoy something, you almost feel you've got to watch it more.
Yeah.
Almost to,
sometimes
the dislike of something can be as fulfilling as the loving of it. So I think I'm just texting something while it's going on in the background.
Yeah.
And I thought, some of those Tolkien-esque lines, those foes of antique and grandiose, must be very difficult to get across as an actor.
Yeah.
And suddenly, I'm doing this on my phone, and Lloyd Owen's character comes on and says his first line, and his thing, he does it off screen, his first line, and I almost flinched, and I said to myself, oh, an actor.
Yeah.
I didn't mean, anything against the other people, and I thought throughout, he's actually putting some meaning in some of these lines. And he comes on stage, and I know that face.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Lloyd is, I remember working with him on some Shakespeare, and Lloyd is fabulous Shakespeare. And I think any actor who does Shakespeare, when you take prose scripts, are able to at least inject a little bit of poetry sometimes into them, and it makes a bit of a difference. But to answer your question about the mask, when I arrived, I was supposed to have this Perspex mask on in front of me, which was going to be frosted out a bit like one of those bathroom window things.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you'd be able to see a sort of a face behind, but not quiet. And I thought, that's quite cool. Because I wasn't expecting to... I was expecting to play one android out of probably 15, where they all come up, one gets shot, one speaks, and then we'd all be different. But Pennant said, no, we've got no budget, so we can't afford another actor. Any more actors, so you're going to have to play them all, which was at once a kind of horrendous and wonderful at the same time, because I realised I had so much more work to do, because I was expecting to just rock up and watch all these amazing actors work and learn something and not have to do very much. But now it was all of this stuff I was responsible for, which I had to get a move on. And then he then turned around to me and said, unfortunately, he said, this graphic of this mask, which is lovely, isn't it? It's a lovely image. Unfortunately, we can't afford that either. So we're going to have to use your own face. To which I then gave the classic line. So you want me to play a monster in Doctor Who and you want me to use my own face. And then he said, well, it won't quite be that. He said, we've got Vanessa Poulton to do your makeup for you, who's won awards for Tenko and all that. Oh, she's lovely. And she used porridge and latex to give it some texture to it. And she said it was to make it look as though I'd come out of a mould, but not a very good one, you know. And then sprayed my hair yellow to make it look a bit wiry as well. Donald Trump stole that. So it was really kind of quite, when I was in the gear and stuff, by the way, if you go on my Facebook, I've got an album there, and it's got some makeup room photos. In makeup. Yeah. So if you want to go in and...
Oh, we'll put a link to that on.
Yeah. It's quite cool, actually.
That's funny. You were saying earlier about, so as Doctor Who fans probably remember better than you do, I said, but in fact, it wasn't an actual mask. It was your face heavily made. Was it blue?
Blue, red. Yeah, and yellow hair. But in the second one I did, which was Great Show in the Galaxy, that was a robot bus conductor.
Yes.
That was like a plastic mask thing that they bolted me into on the hottest day in August.
Yeah. I think it was. Does that mean you couldn't take it off yourself?
No.
So
I was bolted for the whole day.
I've seen that mask.
Yeah. Have you seen it?
Yeah, I've held it as well. It's Mike Tucker made it.
That's right.
I remember when he came originally.
Yeah. And it had no indentation for my nose. So my nose was flattened up against the wall of the plastic for the whole day.
Good Lord.
Which is probably why my conductor sounds a bit nasal. Also, the eyes had gauze in them.
Mm.
Unfortunately, they were set at my eyebrow level.
I think I've worn the same mask, actually, now.
Yeah.
I think he let me put it on.
Yeah, there is one. I was given...
I've worn your mask.
You've worn my mask.
Yeah, I have.
I was given one. Not one that I could wear, but it was one from the dummy, which I gave to a young kid for Christmas, as a Christmas present.
Brilliant.
In Wales. Hopefully he's still got it. Anyway, the mask was very hot and I was screwed into it, but I had to be led everywhere around because I couldn't see anything at all, down the steps of the bus and all of that stuff. So that was quite... And the costume was very hot as well. But, yeah, very uncomfortable, quite painful. And the barrier with a mask on. I did mask work at drama school. George Hall was our brilliant, absolutely brilliant teacher at Central. And... he did a mask workshop with us. And I'd say to anyone who does acting, or even if you don't do acting, if you're a teacher or a student, or, you know, do a mask class. It's the most therapeutic thing you can do. It's quite extraordinary. What happens is that you put the mask on and you've got to use a mirror. You've got to look in the mirror because you've got to see yourself transformed by the mask, whatever you're wearing. And what happens is that you then do it like movements that embody what the mask is sort of telling you. And your physicality changes, your attitude changes, your shy people putting certain masks on become incredibly outgoing. What's quite fascinating is I've done this with teachers. And there are three types of people that you've got to be very careful when you do mask work with. One is teachers, one are people who've been in the army. I can't remember what the third one is. So that's quite dangerous. But they all exhibit violent behaviour when they put masks on.
Oh.
And I find that extraordinary, especially with teachers, why that happens with teachers. I don't know. Maybe it's because there's a suppression of that. Obviously, there's no way you're allowed to. But also with soldiers and that, that's part of their job. And therefore, they've got to be in control of that.
I suppose they're very strict. Yeah. Limited jobs where emotion has to be reined in.
It has to be controlled. Yeah.
To don the mask relieves you of
it
that.
It releases. What it does is it releases those emotions and things.
It's funny, actually, because I do remember once I used to work in a big fruit pack house. And one day I turned up and I'd taken in, I don't know if any of you read Viz, but the character Biffa Bacon. And I had a big latex Biffa Bacon mask. And I put on this big Biffa Bacon mask and this huge jacket, and I walked around the fruit pack house for half an hour goading people, accusing them of spilling my pint, and threatening to start fights with them, and then went back and took the... Nobody knew it was me. But I would never... And it just amused the hell out of me. But as soon as I went back into the cloakroom, I got rid of it. I was like...
Yeah.
But so it does... Yeah, I can totally see how wearing a mask or a disguise as well can just release you. I've even done it just wearing a wig and sunglasses as well once... I was kind of dressed up as like a kind of 90s Mancunian raver once with big flares. My friend's mum's wig, which looked very kind of that baggy Manchester sort of
style.
And I wandered up and down the streets of Faversham asking people ridiculous things in a terrible broad Mancunian accent.
You had a lot to do back in the day,
Mike. We had to make our own film.
Oh, it's interesting. I once saw a documentary about Lon Chaney.
Yeah.
And the agony he put himself through, the prosthetics. I can't remember if it was the Phantom of the Opera or something else where he pushed his nose up.
Yes.
Right. That is and really put it.
Oh, no, that was the Hunchback of Notre Dame. Very famous.
Disfigurement.
But the Phantom as well, his nose is...
Oh, is it? His nose is up as well.
Because there's that famous scene where he turns around and pulls the mask off.
I haven't shown the actress he's working with. But he would actually put his body through the actors.
There are actors that do that. I mean, I work with Daniel Day-Lewis on Hamlet, and I was literally under the stage. There's a corridor that goes from the dressing rooms to the green room. That goes under the Olivier, and I was actually walking through that corridor when he stopped acting on stage and he had his breakdown from doing the show. I think he was absolutely exhausted after he'd done My Left Foot, and then he was doing Hamlet, and then the critics were hammering him, and he was just totally exhausted, and then he had a breakdown in the middle of the show and left.
He's famous for transforming himself completely into the roles, isn't he?
He is, which I think... is brilliant in film, having done, because the great thing with film is that, you stop and start. So actually staying in character is a good thing if you're in film, because otherwise you're constantly, blah, 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 chat, and then you've got to come back in again. Whereas in theatre, you sort of get into character at the start of the show and you carry on all the way through in the character. The trouble is, though, that in theatre, you've got to do it every night.
Mm.
Whereas in film, it's like it's just a short period of time. So you've got to be really careful. We've been doing this for like 6 months or so, and it's a long gig. You do a 4-hour show, and then you get a half hour break in the matinee, and then you do an evening show on top of that. And then you're channeling your relationship with your father, who was the poet laureate. Who died when he was 13, and there's all of that going on inside. I've always said to actors, be careful, don't use acting as therapy. It's not the right place for it, don't get me wrong, Daniel does not use theatre as therapy. That is definitely not where he's coming from. What he's doing is he's going to places that interest him, that intrigue him, that fascinate him, and he's looking into, he's exploring.
There Will Be Blood. That's him, isn't it?
Yes. Drink Your Milkshake, Eli.
Yes. What a film. What a film that is.
Extraordinary actor. Yeah. And a lovely man. I mean, really, really. And strangely, quite shy and introverted.
Now, that's interesting, because when you were talking about Chris Eccleston earlier, I always get the impression, when you see him off camera, off stage, that he's a slight... I don't know if he's slightly shy, or is it maybe he's got a... With the way he is, quite spikily northern, he's got a horror of being a bit over the top. And I remember when he was doing these interviews as we were running up to Doctor Who returning, he was going on things like the Jonathan Ross show.
Yeah.
And Jonathan Ross was saying obvious things. Oh, did you watch Doctor Who when you were a kid?
Yeah.
And he was saying, oh, yes, I used to always look out for the Daleks. And I thought, he's making this up to please his producers. He didn't really do this.
Yeah.
And you think, someone who's quite a powerful actor as that, why would he be showing? I suppose being on, once you go from being you to being someone else, that's like putting a mask on, even if you've not got a physical mask on.
Totally, totally right. I think you're absolutely right. I have found the very, very best actors that I've worked with are of quite self-deprecating and quite shy and a little bit insecure, maybe not really quite sure of themselves, always putting themselves down a little bit, maybe. But as soon as they're on stage, I mean, Judy is the classic of all time for me. I was stood next to her as we were going on in Hamlet, and we got on really well in rehearsal, and we'd established this sort of, we were making each other laugh. And she's standing there, and she's fiddling with these beads. And I said, are you nervous? And she says, oh, dear, what a stupid way to make a living. Because she swears like a trooper. Oh, insert, swear word of your choice there. And I promise you, it won't be as rude as she did. And then she gave her famous giggle, And I said, but surely all the things you've done, surely. She said, no. She said, it just gets worse, because as you get more experience, you realize how much more can go wrong.
Oh.
That you have no control over. And so you really are going out on a tightrope with no safety. When you're young, you think,
you don't have the awareness.
You don't have the awareness. You just suddenly don't have the experience of things going, so terribly wrong. That you can walk out on stage knowing your lines, and then suddenly, bang, oh, God, I can't remember what I was about to say. And that's happened to me, and it's terrifying. You wake up in the middle of the night, the actor's dream, is the actor's nightmare. You're thrown on stage, to fill in, so-and-so's dropped out. You need to go on for them, and you play that part last week, and you go out and you can't remember the lines.
Sometimes it's bad enough just being a stagehand and forgetting which rope you need to pull to open the curtains on a performance of Liaisons Dangereuses back in about 1999. And I do apologise to all the actors and actresses on stage. It involved my faffing about where I left half the stage covered by the... On the opening scene, I only opened up half the stage curtains. And I had this stage manager shouting in my ear. And I think somebody had to come down and pull you. But fortunately, I think the scene managed to open the curtain just as someone was walking on from that side. And it kind of looked almost like it was deliberate. So I just about got away with it. But I wasn't put on the stage curtains again, so... Yes, anything can go wrong.
It can.
The audience were thinking...
Because it's not in your control, is it? That's the other thing.
Well,
it's other people
unless you're, as well. Unless you're working sound and lighting at St. George's Theatre in Tufnell Park and you're doing Macbeth and you're supposed to be queuing up mysterious wind sound when Macbeth is overcome by the witches before he's killed, and you actually queue up a fanfare instead. And then you panic because you realise that it's the queue before, and instead of turning down the volume, you rewind the tape so that what you get is...
Oh, fantastic.
Have you ever heard of Mischief Theatre?
No.
The play that goes wrong?
Yeah,
just reminded me.
Yeah, no, I love all of that stuff.
Yeah.
It's brilliant because, that's the thrill of it. That's why we get such a high when we do these things.
Yeah.
Because they are so extraordinary. But I've always said, and I say to Lila, we must never be, when things go wrong, we must never worry because we've got something interesting to talk about. If everything goes perfectly well, you don't have any stories to tell, which is great.
Well, indeed, if I hadn't have done that thing at the Marlowe Theatre back in 1999, nobody'd be interested in me talking about it. and maybe they aren't anyway.
We never interviewed Dean. We might never have heard your revelation about your Biff and Bacon mug.
I do end up interrupting and talking about myself.
I've changed the world twice now.
You've been working on a film recently?
Yeah. I was in Othello in Guernsey a few years back, and Macbeth as well by the same, in the same theatre company, Moore Theatre, which was founded by Andrew Hislop, who was at National Youth Theatre a few years after me. Lovely actor, fabulous actor. So we both in Guernsey. He invited me along to play in The Porter, which I'd always wanted to play because I did Macbeth at A level. And in Othello, I played the father of Desdemona. I can't remember his name. I get cast as so I can hear people shouting it into the. And one of the young actors in it, who played Banquo, rang me up afterwards. Lovely actor, Cameron Ashpart. And his brother Brandon was in it as well. Very good actors, young actors. And Cameron rang me up and said, would you like to do a film? And I was sort of very skeptical. I thought, not really. You know, it's difficult remembering lines and things. And it's taking time out. And, you know, I want to spend time on grandsons and my wife. And do I really want to spend time on a film? And he said, I said, what's it about? He said, it's a Western. I went, I'm in. I'm in. He said, I said, where are you going to do it? He said, I'm going to do it here. And he goes, how are you going to do that? Brilliant. I mean, I'm always interested in something that's like not anything I've done before or challenging or anything that's kind of just vaguely off center, you know? So I thought, yeah, definitely in for that. And then he sent me the script. And I love the script because it's about this young Army Confederate sergeant who he's obviously something a bit weird about him. And there's an Indian or a wild man who's still living in the forest. And he gets into his head that he wants to kill the last wild man and eradicate the last Native American, if you like. So he gets this bounty hunter, Andy Hislop, to go out and kill him. But Andy, I won't ruin the film. There's a nice interaction between the two of them. And then I come along. And I'm part of the story as well in terms of getting rid of this Indian guy. And it's only a short, but it's going to be, we think we might have secured the Prince Charles Cinema in Leicester Square to do the premiere in September. So after 40 years, I've finally got my red carpet. I'm taking Lila along to impress my wife.
I thought you were saying finally got my equity card. Yes. What's the film called?
Well, it's on the IMDb database, and I always can't remember the name of it because it's quite long. It's the Last Flamingo of the Red Summer Sunset, something like that.
It's acceptable to forget a name like that, isn't it?
Well, the other thing, of course, when you're doing films, is that very often, I mean, we did it in a day, I think. Or 2 days, maybe, the scenes that I was doing. So it's very quick. You just come in, you do the scene, and then you don't see anything. You don't even know how it looks. But I saw a little preview of it, which is on YouTube, and actually, he's shot it really well.
Oh,
he's
got well done. Some nice. Last Flamingo of the Red Summer
It is. Sunset.
We can put links to that in the notes as well.
Yeah. Brabantio,
well done, sir. Well done.
Entirely off Google as well. Yeah.
Well, I now work for Guernsey Electricity, and I work in the IT department, and I always say to people, I'm one Google search ahead of you.
Well, thanks very much for talking to us, Dean. We should know if we ever, we've got this end now, if we ever meet Chris Reckleston or want to interview him, we can try your Pennant Roberts technique and say, well, you know, we were talking to Dean Hollingsworth, and he said, I should meet to Chris. And
but, you know, I've got to say, there's something about that is interesting because I've been looking at some, you know, like Chris has done a biography and stuff, and his interviews of how he got started and stuff. He never mentions us at all. And it's always intrigued me why. Now, there was a little bit of controversy about when we were working together, but that doesn't really matter very much at all, but he might be thinking that he doesn't want to upset anyone in terms of, you know, that sort of time. But as far as I'm concerned, he was absolutely, you know, spot on, deserved everything he got in terms of getting his card. Everything was done properly and no problems at all as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, you never know.
So what have you got left on the tackle this week? Anything thrilling, or you'd
I think we're having lunch with Howard next, and then I think we're done. We're flying back to Guernsey tonight on the last flight, which is should be quite easy because it's all downhill. And
well, you shall take the good wishes of Doctor Who fans everywhere, lifting you off the
Thank you very much. I'm a big fan myself, and you know, this is, for me, it's a big privilege to be able to meet so many, you know, amazing people. We've made lifelong friends here. And we've only met them through the conventions. And I was in Germany this year at the Time Lash in Kassel. And we talked about the fact that it had the feeling of a family, you know, and there's very much that feel here. You know, it's lots of laughs and lots
of family in church, but a family.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Although my family doesn't dress up quite as amazingly as you guys do. That's great. Thank you for your time.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Dean.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at Diddly Dum, on iTunes at Diddly Dum Podcast, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum, the empty space that circles time.